Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Stuart Acuff with Utility Workers Union of America, asking you to tune in every time you can to Bob Carson's Carson's Corner, one of the best pro-labor shows in America. We love it at Utility Workers. We love it across the AFL-CIO, and we're grateful to Bob for coming on and holding up our issues and holding up our principles and values.
I'm Andrew Craig. I'm an investigative reporter and attorney based in Washington, and I'm the author of Presidential Puppetry, Obama, Romney, and Their Masters. And I want to encourage everyone to support, listen to, and talk about the Carson's Corner show in New Jersey, which is a pioneering, courageous, and apt voice for progressives in New Jersey that I first came to know in 2009 when he was the pioneering and virtually unique media outlet willing to take on Chris Christie, dig deep, and look at how he had come to power and how he was misusing it. And 4 years, 5 years later here, that's all come to pass.
Hi, this is David K. Johnston, and you're listening to Carson's Corner with Bob Carson.
This is Lamar Waldron, the author of Ultimate Sacrifice and Legacy of Secrecy, those two books, the latter of which will become a movie produced and starring Leonardo DiCaprio in 2013. And you are listening to Carson's Corner with Bob Carson on Underground Progressive Radio.
This is Les Leopold, the author of How to Make $1 Million an Hour. And I just want to tell you that you'll get a rich and rewarding experience by listening to Carson's Corner.
This is Greg Palast, reporter for BBC Television and Democracy Now, and author of the new book, Vulture's Picnic, In Pursuit of Petroleum Pigs, Power Pirates, and High Finance Carnivores. And you're listening to Carson's Corner on 5:30 a.m. Underground Progressive Radio, radio for the 99%. Help us occupy the airwaves and support Carson's Corner and support 5:30 Underground Progressive Radio.
Hi, this is Frank Schaefer, author of Sex, Mom, and God. You're listening to Carson's Corner, a show I enjoy. I hope you enjoy it, too. I encourage you to listen.
Welcome to a very special edition of Carson's Corner in conjunction with the CommonsProjectNetwork.com here on Blog Talk Radio. My name is Bob Carson. We're so pleased to be with you here this Monday afternoon. We are going to be welcoming our old friend back to the show, Frank Schaefer. He's a New York Times bestselling author. He's got more than a dozen fiction and nonfiction books. People have seen him on television before. He is an A-list guest that we're honored to have on the program to discuss his latest book that he's got out, which is called Why I Am an Atheist Who Believes in God, How to Create Beauty, Give Love, and Find Peace. That's a very, very intriguing title that really boggles the mind, and that's why we wanted to have Frank on. He's going to be on the program. We're going to reach out to him right about now. And from there, after that, I want to discuss The Case for Socialism, written by Alan Mas, which is a very, very kitchen table way of explaining the case for socialism. Very important concepts in this book, I think, that we all can learn from. It's not your gobbledygook. It's not over-intellectualized. And it was recommended to me by my good friend Brad Hulhut, who, by the way, I'll be seeing later on in the month at the Left Forum at the John Jay College. A lot of speakers. I volunteered, and hopefully I'll be able to broadcast an edition of Carson's Corner from that venue. Well, without further ado, let's go to Frank Schaefer now. Let's try to get him on the phone here.
Hello?
Frank?
Yeah.
Hey, Frank, can you hear me?
Yeah, who is it?
Hey, it's Bob Carson of Carson's Corner.
Oh, okay, good. Yeah, I can hear you now. I think you called a minute ago and I couldn't hear anything.
Yeah, we put you in the waiting room and for some reason it wasn't functioning correctly. But thankfully, we got you on the line here. We want to discuss your new book, Why I Am an Atheist Who Believes in God, How to Create Beauty, Give Love, and Find Peace. This is your second book in a year or so, correct?
Well, yeah. The other one was a novel that I'd been working on for 17 years called And God Said Billy. So it really wasn't the same thing, kind of apples and oranges. And this is a shorter book, and, of course, it's literary nonfiction, so it's a completely different genre. And also I'd been working on it for a while. So the two projects kind of developed concurrently, but they came out pretty close together, yes.
You know, what was amazing is just, I haven't read the book yet, but just the title is very, very intriguing, Why I Am an Atheist Who Believes in God. And just to wrap, can you help people at home wrap their head around that title? Because it seems like a very, very complex title and something that really boggles the mind.
Well, here's the deal. You know, I've written a number of books, as you know, because we're friends and we've been talking about these things, like Crazy for God, which is a memoir about my journey out of the evangelical community. And all through that process of writing those books, I've been getting emails, and I'm not exaggerating when I say literally thousands. And by the way, I answer all my own email, believe it or not, and it takes a lot of work, but I've had a very vivid, lively correspondence with a whole bunch of people that say, hey, listen, you're not alone. We've taken this journey. And there's a whole other class of people out there that if you watch the media, and it's all new atheists like Christopher Hitchens was, or Dawkins, or these other people, on one hand, fundamentalist Christians and evangelicals on the other, like Billy Graham or his son Franklin, you would think the world was divided into, you know, a bunch of mutually exclusive fanatics. And really, it's much more complicated than that. And most of us are not just one label. You know, so I call myself a Christian. I'm a believer sometimes, but in other ways, I'm somebody who has a lot of doubts and questions, and there are times of real unbelief. So this book, Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God, is really a book about wrapping our arms around paradox and accepting it instead of fighting it. And that's really why I've written this book, because there are a lot of people in that boat. I'm one of those people. But I don't do it by making a bunch of didactic or intellectual points. I just simply tell stories from my own life, my relationship with my grandchildren, which is one reason I go to church, a life of prayer, whether I think I'm being heard or not, and admit the fact that I believe what I believe because I was my parents' son and not so much an intellectual choice. So I try to write an honest book which really deals with the complexity and the paradox of faith and unbelief. And I guess the way I put it is this way in the book, and that is that, you know, I've never met an atheist or a Christian. I've only met people who are of more than one mind at any given moment and who vacillate from one thing to another and essentially are conflicted. So, you know, that's kind of a long-winded answer, but maybe gives you an idea of the flavor of it.
It does, and it kind of coincides with Phyllis Tickle, who wrote a review on your book. She's the former religion editor of Publisher Weekly of The Age of the Spirit, and she wrote that Schaefer's openness about his own wrestling with the concepts of God and godness, which he inherited from his parents, is heart-trending at times, but it also is deadly honest and always unshielded. The latter part of that, deadly honest and always unshielded, what do you think she's referring to there?
Well, you know, I can't assess whether I'm deadly honest or not, but I guess what she's assessing is this. You know, I think a lot of people wear their labels, and to be honest with you, when it comes to religion or atheism for that matter, they earn their living. I mean, let's just imagine hypothetically that Richard Dawkins has a covert life of prayer. That something has stuck from his, you know, background. He's not about to talk about that because then he doesn't get invited on Bill Maher anymore as the token atheist. He's not going to talk about his doubts and that when he looks up into the cosmos at night some night, he realizes that we're just barely evolved creatures and that it's ridiculous to be making these huge cosmological questions, statements. He's just never going to say that because his bread and butter comes from his certainty just like Franklin Graham's does. Franklin Graham's not going to tell you one day that, look, between you and me, there's a lot of times I don't believe any of this, and I take into account the possibility that the whole thing is hogwash, everything I base my life on. But are you telling me he's never had that thought? That's like me saying, look, you know, I've been married 43 years. I've never lusted for another woman. I've never wanted to have a quick, you know, roll in the sack with someone. Bullshit. Of course I have. I've also stuck with the same woman I'm married to, but it would be a complete falsehood. So when Phyllis Tickle talks about this kind of deadly honesty in my book, it's because I lay it out. I say, hey, listen, there are big chunks of my life when I look at what I supposedly was raised with and I realize, listen, I haven't made any choice about this. You know, what I say in the book, why I'm an atheist who believes in God, is that while that statement may seem contradictory, it is a true picture, not just of me, but I'm betting most people, and not just about atheism, about who you love, about your career, about the fact that you studied law and were so certain this would be a great career. You get into it, now you're thinking maybe you should have been an artist. You know, let's get real here and stop talking in terms of these certainties where you get, quote-unquote, saved at a Billy Graham rally when you're 19. When you're 56 years old, are you supposed to still be having that same simplistic version of faith? Either you become a kind of an indoctrinated, cultic figure or someone who's following a cult, or you're still thinking for yourself. So I don't think I've done anything unusual. What is unusual about why I'm an atheist who believes in God is that I have just laid it out and not written a book on doubt, like how to get over your doubts. You know, other evangelical types have written books on doubt, like, hey, this is natural, doubting Thomas, blah, 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 blah. Here's how you get over your doubt and deal with it. I'm saying don't get over your doubt. In fact, embrace complexity, embrace nuance, embrace paradox. That's actually the way things are because life's not really long enough to draw all these huge conclusions, whether it's Christian conclusions or atheist conclusions. Let's just deal with that. We're all more than one person. The same things with gay and straight. I've never met a gay person. I've never met a straight person. Listen, I went to boarding school in the UK when I was, 10, 12 years old. We used to have these sort of group masturbation sessions. This was what British boys' school was all about. Did half of us turn out to be committed gay people our whole life? Absolutely not. But on the other hand, do I have no sense of what a gay experience might be like had I been born with a different proclivity to go in that direction? Of course I do. But most people will never admit stuff like that because they're saying, hey, no, I identify myself as a heterosexual. I'd never admit that I'd had any urges in a different direction. That's what I'm talking about, this sort of complexity and nuance, but also that paradox is not a bad thing. Embrace it. We're all more than one person.
Well, this forces the audience to really think outside the box. And, you know, you bring up such a good point that I think you can apply this point to a lot of other areas. You know, you talk about how, you know, individuals' bread and butter is advancing, a particular idea or particular cause. But if you're truly intellectually curious, if you are Franklin Graham, you have to wonder at some point, is everything I've said a lie or is, everything I said, can it be proven otherwise? And if you're not going to be intellectually honest with yourself, then you're probably going to continue to do what you're doing on the air. And that's what we see when it comes to every issue that the media covers, when it comes to economics, when it comes to just about everything else, because people's bread and butter, in order for them to get invited back on the television shows or the radio shows, they have to play a particular role, which I think dilutes the entire concept.
I mean, listen, let's be honest. You know, there are nights when Rachel Maddow sitting there on MSNBC, I've been her guest a number of times, I like Rachel. Were you telling me that she doesn't once in a while think to herself, hey, you know, this right-wing Republican talking about pro-life issues has a point, but I can't go there because my persona is formed, and I have to defend a particular point of view. But in this particular case, this late-term abortion, I'm horrified if I could say what I'm really thinking. Politics, listen, you know, Barack Obama sometimes has thoughts that don't fit his political agenda, and he's stuck. You know, Prince Charles probably sits down one night once in a while and says, you know, the royalty's a ridiculous idea. Can you imagine what I'm stuck with? Oh, well, hey, this is me. I'm here. But if you don't embrace that paradox, you only have two choices. This is what I've concluded in the book, you know, Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God, and that is, look, you can either admit the fact that we're all in a rudderless boat and there is no way to steer this precisely in the direction you choose, or pretend that you're a Christian because there's good reasons to be. Hey, get over it. If you're a Christian, it's because you were born in North America in the 20th or the 21st century instead of being born in Riyadh. If you're an atheist, it's because you went to certain schools or you read a book by Christopher Hitchens or you rebelled against your fundamentalist parents or you have a certain genetic predisposition. So one of the things that I talk about in the book is that, especially given what neuroscience is doing about brain development, you know, we have far few choices than we think. It's either genetic or it's environment. And yes, you can make moral choices, and yes, you can fight against certain things if you don't like aspects of your character. But this idea of, like, I choose to believe this, and so it's got to be right because I've come to this long process of decision, whether it's religion or science or anything else, there are only one kind of argument, and there is only one kind of argument, and that is they're all circular arguments. So Christians quote the Bible. Dawkins quotes science. It's all self-referential. But the question that I ask in the book, whether it's cosmology or religion or how big or small we are in the universe or our significance, hey, one question should stop all these discussions dead in their tracks. Compared to what? What is that? What is the independent point of reference against which any of these claims, secular or religious, can be measured outside of our sphere right here on this little spaceship we call Earth? So I think what Phyllis Tickle's talking about is I've kind of taken the lid off what I think for most people are private thoughts that they don't really want to risk questioning their label because either they earn their living as a pastor or a youth worker or a scientist or whatever. So they don't really want to say that, you know, they're a secular modern person, but they have certain superstitions they stick with religiously. They don't want to say they're a Christian, but they have doubts. They don't want to say that they're gay, but sometimes they look at a man or a woman and have a sexual attraction. They want to wear their label and be safe inside that. And that's where I think a kind of a lying comes in all our national discourse. It sees everything cut and dried, black and white. And I've tried to write a little book, which is very accessible. It's short. It's inexpensive. It's a nice read. It's got a lilt to it. I think it's some of the better writing I've done. And, you know, just make this argument for people to say, hey, listen, stop agonizing over these issues and instead just deal with the fact that that's who we are as human beings. We're semi-evolved primates trying to draw cosmological conclusions, and I blink from having been single-celled creatures floating in the water somewhere. So let's get real and just deal with where we're really at. That's what I'm trying to talk about. Yet, on the other hand, explaining my own life of faith, why I still go to church, all that being the case, admit I'm there because that's how my parents raised me, but nevertheless, that doesn't make it, meaningless to me. So be honest about this stuff, but at the same time, embrace who you are and don't try to resolve the contradiction. Life is a contradiction. That's what the book is about.
It seems like that this is a well-developed intellectual book here. There's no question about it. And, you know, you mentioned that you talk about your upbringing and the rigidness there and how it shaped your experiences as an adult. Do you delve into at all, the current state of atheism or religion and politics? Do you at all touch upon that or maybe make, references to that in this book?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I've written about that in the past in things like my memoir, Crazy for God. But, yeah, of course I do, because it's unavoidable. Look, you know, we're all stuck with whatever our particular pasts are. And as I talk about in the book, part of my past is coming out of the religious right as the sidekick and the nepotistic sidekick of an evangelist and Christian intellectual in the 70s who helped form the religious right. And I was a sidekick. I was out there on the platform with him. I was flying around the country in Jerry Falwell's borrowed jet, talking to the national religious broadcasters and meeting with Ronald Reagan and all the rest of it. I talk a little bit about my journey out of that, but not so much in this case as a memoir, but to give context of the liberating effect of, in the end, saying, listen, you know, here's my journey, but it's not like I've converted to some higher truth I have simply converted to embracing the fact that whether we admit it or not, the truth of our lives is paradoxical. These things all continue with us. So, yeah, I say I left that background. But let me be honest. I brought a lot of that baggage with me. In the deep, dark recesses of the night and guilt feelings and all the rest, there's a lot of me that still pulls me back psychologically to those fundamentalist roots. It even shows up in some of my blogging. You know, I was one of Huffington Post's first bloggers, and some of my blogs are very widely read, and I find myself sort of pulling fundamentalist stunts sometimes in those blogs, less now, but a few years ago, it's like, okay, this is all in the cause of enlightenment and the left and everything, but there's still a nasty tone to it. I'm still, you know, painting enemies with a overbroad brush and generalizing. Hey, I'm not really so far from the fundamentalism I was once in, and I got to lean against it. And so, you know, I'm trying to be honest about that, too, in this book. This idea that, you know, somehow we're proceeding to greater and greater enlightenment, I don't think so. I think we bring our character with us. You can't escape that part of ourselves.
Now, the book itself, I wanted to ask you, actually, I kind of am having a brain fart here, but I wanted to ask you if, do you think that the religious right and religion in general has the same amount, more or declining power over the political system in America?
No, I think it still has the same amount of power. I mean, look at Mark Rubio just this week denying climate change and saying it's not related very much to human activity because he gets his money from the Koch brothers who make their money out of a filthy coal industry and oil pollution just desecrating our planet. And you know, Rubio doesn't want to rock the boat. He's no fool. He knows exactly what he's doing. And this, you know, it's the old Stalinist thing. You want to make an omelet, you got to break eggs. And a lot of these right-wing people are much smarter than the public they serve, but they go with the party line. You know, they're asked about evolution. You can't tell me that most of these educated political operatives in Washington don't believe in evolution, but they hedge. They say, oh, well, it's just a theory. Same with global climate change. Of course, the religious right has tremendous impact still, not in terms of national numbers, but over the primary process of the Republican Party. They control it. And we'll see how it shakes out in the next election. And, you know, my book does get into some of that because that's my background. And also just in terms of dismissing and denouncing this kind of certain sure absolutism, whether it's from the right or the left, that has colored our political discourse. But I think, you know, just to reverse it for a minute, if you look at some of the new atheist movement, they talk in almost those same absolutist terms. You would think that they had cosmological enlightenment, again, from outside our planet somewhere, giving them absolute perspective on the human condition. Well, nobody has that. So I just think the religious right has, in a way, one of the things it's done is driven good secular thinking people a little bit crazy because they've become as shrill as the people they've had to stand up against, and that's part of our problem. And, you know, my book is just saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, let's be truthful here. When it comes to our personal idea of faith and belief, whether it's atheism or Gnosticism or some point in between, you know, it's never, never quite as cut and dried as all these public positions people take.
Now, I want to kind of switch topics here a little bit because one of your cornerstones or one of the things that you've spoken out about for years is right-wing extremism. That's, you know, within the religious community, but also outside of the religious community, the right-wing militancy of America. And I remember years ago, you were on Rachel Maddow's show, and you said something very prophetic. You said that what the right-wing rhetoric that we hear on, you know, Fox News and right-wing talk radio is basically almost similar to leaving a loaded gun on the table and waiting for someone to pick it up and use it. And we could document the various different right-wing acts of terrorism that may or may not have been caused by such rhetoric. Do you think the political landscape has changed over the last, you know, five years or so, 6 years or so, from the time of the Department of Homeland Security report, you know, chronicling the right-wing extremism that faces us? Or do you think it's sort of went into the back burner, still there, but maybe not as prevalent as it was during maybe the healthcare debate or you know, when Barack Obama was elected?
Well, if you could put it this way, maybe the one good thing that came out of the government shutdown was a sort of a false sense of empowerment for the Looney Tunes who thought they were going to have to assassinate the president. You know, with the leading of people by people like Ted Cruz, they were given a mouthpiece for the extreme right. So even their conspiracy theories about the takeover of the government by a communist or a Muslim or whatever else, or a Kenyan, were somewhat diffused because, in a way, you know, their shrill, you know, the craziest shrill fringe of the Tea Party gave way to people like Rubio and Ted Cruz, who basically said, hey, no, you know, we can mobilize and use the system. So in one way, they didn't use it. They're the party of revolution because they're the party of no, and they shut the government and they risked the world economy and they created more economic problems. But on the other hand, some of the victories gave a sense of empowerment to some guy sitting in a basement clutching a gun and collecting ammunition. I mean, as you know, all the ammo sold out across the country. You couldn't get any ammunition for a while because these idiots were thinking, you know, the United Nations or something was going to come take their guns away. I mean, it always makes me feel crazy to talk about this because they're so crazy. But I think actually some of the successes of the Tea Party mobilizing these people probably lowered the number of actual assassination threats that the Secret Service was dealing with. For instance, at the beginning of the presidency, you had that bumper sticker saying, may his children be fatherless, quoting one of the Psalms, and you had all these threat levels so high that the Secret Service was saying it was like 500% more than anything else they had recorded with another president. My guess is a little of that tension has gone away because, let's be sadly honest, the Tea Party succeeded in stalling and destroying a big part of a very promising presidency. And I think the amazing thing is that Obama has gotten anything done, given that he's faced a kind of a racist, white, aging population backlash against just everything he does. I mean, the ultimate irony is he takes Mitt Romney's plan crafted by the Heritage Foundation for expanding coverage through private insurance, and all of a sudden that's a communist plot being run by an African from Kenya. So, you know, that's kind of where we've been at. I don't know if that strikes anything you're thinking in terms of making a little bit of sense.
Oh, there's no doubt about it, and we're seeing this type of activity recently with the Clive and Bundy situation and the amount of extremism shown there, and now you've got all these protests, you know, concerning government land and whatnot, federally leased land and the extremism there. And so, no, it hasn't gone away. It's the unfortunate thing, Frank, is that the corporate media focuses on this, I think, for obvious reasons. But what gets left out are, you know, the Occupy protests, the various different, you know, minimum wage protests and fast food worker rights protests and so on and so forth. And so, you know, I still think it's prevalent and it still has.
Oh, I do too. And the right wing is in no sense going away. These guys are absolutely vicious, and they would, I wrote a long piece, if people want to Google it, the slow motion lynching of President Barack Obama, and it went viral. I mean, the thing had over 104,000 shares, let alone readers. I mean, millions of readers, including the Guardian of Nigeria picked it up and so on. So it just went wild. But I just called it like I saw it. I said, hey, listen, you know, I'm a 62-year-old white man, former Republican. I come from this background, and as far as I'm concerned, you know, race is really what this is about and nothing but that. And sure, there are other issues, but the level of vitriol combined with just sheer lying is just unbelievable. So, yes, you know, the left said nasty things about George W. Bush, but nothing even approached it.
Yeah.
Plus, there was still a bipartisan attempt and an ability to do some legislation. But, you know, these guys won't let him do anything. And so everything he does is just simply either by political maneuvering or, you know, blind luck. I mean, they shut down the U.S. government to try to prevent what essentially was a Republican plan hatched by the Heritage Foundation for insurance coverage.
Yep. And you've mentioned they've gotten their way, that they have, because the Obama administration has done nothing but cut. They've created the model for austerity. They've abided by, you know, the parameters of a Tea Party. And as a result of that, now we have you know, government spending that is very, very low. We have a deficit that's, you know, one third of the size that it was, you know, when Obama came into office, and means there's no more reinvestment. There's no type of investment. And
well, and our infrastructure is struggling. So, you know, our infrastructure structure is struggling, and then on top of that, anybody who's traveled anywhere outside of the United States understands that other people's trains work, their airports are clean and work, and everything works, functions, their bridges aren't collapsing. We have followed this kind of ideal of no spending into a kind of cul-de-sac, which has nothing to do with even politics. And these guys have kept their nose off despite their faces to the point where even industry and commerce, which supposedly they are for, has been decimated. I mean, infrastructure, you can't have a thriving economy without infrastructure, and we don't even have that. So, you know, this is the extremism of shutting the government down and willing to risk the faith and credit of the United States was just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, these guys have damaged our economy for decades, no matter who's in office, simply because they've allowed our infrastructure to rot. Look, I mean, we're now almost 40 years behind on the curve for high-speed rail. We can't. Yep. The Chinese have built an entire system over a landmass as big as ours in 15 years.
Yep. That's the cycle of disinvestment.
You know,
Chuck Collins talks about the cycle of disinvestment, how, you know, the wealthy do not want their tax dollars allocated to certain public services, and as a result, tax dollars are no longer used to, you know, provide for the general welfare. They're used to, you know, for corporate subsidies. I mean, we could just go on and on and on. But, Frank, listen, I'm going to pick up the book, Why I Am an Atheist Who Believes in God, How to Create Beauty, Give Love, and Find Peace. People can check out your website at www.frankschaefer.com. Anywhere else you want people to go to check out your work?
Well, yeah, I mean, the book's on Amazon, and it's in paperback right now, and by the end of the week it'll be on Kindle and in all the other forms, eventually iBook and all the rest. But the point is, you know, if they read it and are interested, just get in touch with me through frankschaefer.com, you know, let's keep the discussion going here and not allow everything to just freeze into two opposing camps, one calling itself atheist, one calling itself believing, both of which terms are meaningless because everything's by degrees and it's all individual. So, you know, that's the discussion we're trying to have.
Yeah, it is. It's a brilliant discussion, which is something you're not going to hear too often on the corporate-owned, corporate-sponsored, corporate-driven media, and that's why it's so important. Frank, thanks again for coming on the show. If we could just get you to do a quick promo. We're recording now. You know, just mention maybe the title of your new book and whatever else comes to mind, and
sure.
We'll play it. Thank you.
Sure. Hey, this is Frank Schaefer, author, writer, New York Times bestseller. But I'm here today because I've got a new book called Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God. And I'm also on Carson's Corner because corporate media is so one-dimensional in terms of the kind of things they cover that they couldn't comprehend a discussion that would begin with a statement that implies a huge paradox. But I think there's a lot of thinking people out there who understand that life is paradoxical, and Carson's Corner is one of those places you can discuss it. So thanks for being with us.
Franks, thanks a lot. I really appreciate it. We'll talk to you sometime down the road, my friend.
That'd be great. Thanks for having me on.
Okay, take care.
Okay, bye.
All right, that was Frank Schaefer here on Carson's Corner. Great, great public speaker, great, highly intellectual individual. And that's why we love having him on the program. And you know what? Let me tell you something. And I think I posted this on Facebook, and this is very important. There are few guys that I know of in politics or in MMA that have such esteem, such credibility as Frank Schaefer that will do independent media. You just won't find it too often. You know, now everything, there's a calculation. There's, oh, you know, how many listeners or how many this and that, and there's just this business calculation that I think makes people avoid shows like this. So that is a very, very important detail. It really is. We hit on a number of different key issues with Frank, but I'm definitely going to pick up the book. It's going to be one of my next books that I order. I read Sex, Mom, and God I think that's the name of the book that he released in 2011. Frank actually mailed that to me. I read that in one day. And that's rare for me because usually I don't read a book in one day. But I literally read it in about 8 hours. And it was just absolutely great. And I like the idea that he's challenging certain assertions. He's challenging certain positions. Outside of the box analysis is what we're all about here on Carson's Corner. Now, I want to talk to you about some concepts in the book by Alan Moss, The Case for Socialism, because I just read this book. Actually, I read it last month. I'm going to be on to my next book, but I didn't get a chance to really talk about this because it's been a couple of weeks since we did a political show, and I've been kind of all over the place. I'm in the process of relocating now. I'm going to be moving in with a relative, which is really embarrassing, but as a result of the economy, my roommate leaving, and my car broke down, I could just give you a laundry list of the conditions, the problems associated with an economic system that we have. And Alan Moss challenges this economic system in the book, The Case for Socialism. And one of the things that he points out, and again, you know, there are many concepts in this book, as there is in any book. You know, most people only will remember 5 to 10% of what they read. And that's true. I mean, I sometimes read these books twice so I can absorb more information. But, you know, one of the things that he points out in this book is the idea that we tolerate an economic system that does not provide clothing for the poor, shelter for the homeless, food for the hungry. Capitalism does the exact opposite, right? I mean, you know, in this country, if you don't make enough money, if you don't have the purchasing power to buy things, then your life is, you know, really runs along those lines. So Peter Joseph has talked about how the sequence of money, the movement of money, is more important than the sequence of life in America. It's more important that money changes hands and money moves around the economy than it is for people to live well and for people to advance in our society. And that's what capitalism breeds. And another thing that Alan points out, and this is along the same lines here, is the fact that we have an economic system that's based on scarcity, okay? If you want to talk about socialism and you want to really remember one concept that is very important to socialism, it is abundance. Abundance is basically making sure that there's enough to go around. There's enough resources to go around, okay? That includes natural resources, which we know that is the case. That includes homes. You know that in the United States of America, according to some estimates, you've got 17 homes for every homeless person out there. Homelessness, despite what you hear from the government statistics, is on the rise. A number of different people, myself included, I'm technically homeless because I'll be living with a relative soon. Okay, most people may not want to admit that, but that's the reality of the situation. And so we have an economic system in America that says it's okay for people to go without food. It's okay for people to go without homes, without shelter, without medical care, if it doesn't involve a profit, if money cannot be made by the business class, those that own the means of production. And what happens as a result of this, as a result of having an economic system that is based on scarcity, keeping things valuable, is class war. It's class division. Because now, you know, we touched upon this with Frank Schaefer, the racialization of our politics, how going back to the 1960s, it was Barry Goldwater that said that The war on poverty is a war on your pocketbook. And this notion still exists today, this associating economic policies with race and basically dividing the classes to make sure that the very wealthy, the ownership class, continues their economic superiority is still alive and well in the United States, and it's not going away anytime soon. It's called the Southern Strategy. Everything is you know, boiled down to race, dog whistle politics, you know, tax cuts for the very wealthy. What that means is what we were talking about before, the cycle of disinvestment, the idea that my money, you know, if you're a wealthy person, your money should not go to subsidize the public schools. Public schools have minority children in them. They have the poor person. And why should my tax dollar go to help a poor person? You know, this is how these people think. You know, this is what the elites believe in America. And so what results out of this is a society in which we are vastly unequal in terms of wealth and income. And there's no real discussion about that. You know, no real discussion whatsoever, because we're not allowed to discuss that. You know, we understand that. It is not allowed to enter into the arena of debate. We are, you know, the victims of a class assault in which we're not allowed to talk about. All the government cutting that we're talking, the spending cuts that have taken place, you know, as a result of President Obama and the Tea Party, that is a structural assault on us. That is a class assault on us. And it has everything to do with race, as George H. Walker Bush or George Bush the First's Willie Horton had. You know, this is all adapted in order for us to really become distracted by issues of race and any other issue that could be used to divide us so that the very wealthy can maintain economic supremacy. And that's what it's all about. And that's what Alan Moss talks about in his book, The Case for Socialism. Now, keep in mind, ladies and gentlemen, that to a certain extent, we do have socialism in America. All right? People, the American people take socialism for granted. They're conditioned to fear socialism, to associate socialism with what took place, you know, in Russia during the Stalin era. They're conditioned to associate socialism with what the outputs, the economic circumstances in Cuba, which by some measures is not good. But in actuality, according to Alan Moss, those governments, those countries do not practice true socialism, which is the workers having complete control and say over the decisions that ultimately, you know, govern their lives. There really isn't too many socialist nations using that definition. But, you know, one of the things that I want to emphasize to people out there is that our police departments, our military, government responses to crises, they are basically socialist in nature. Okay, you know, anybody, our roads, our public transportation system, anybody can call a police officer and get a response regardless of their income. The police departments are a government service that we pay for through our tax dollars. Anybody can travel on a public road, regardless of the money that they make, regardless of whether or not if they pay federal income taxes. Anybody can go and use a public park, a billionaire or a poor person, okay? And these areas of our society, they are appreciated by everybody. Nobody wants to privatize the police department. Nobody wants to. We've had privatized police departments in America. We've had private privatized fire departments, and those that paid a fee to the fire department would have a fire extinguished at their house. But what we found happened during those days is that that system didn't work, because those that paid a fee to have a fire department put out a fire, their house would catch on fire if somebody next to them. It became a public danger to have privatized fire departments in America. And so that is when we really form the acknowledgement that the public good, the general welfare of the public, is more important than, you know, a business interest. It's more important than an ideology that seeks to privatize our very institutions. Okay? And so these are areas of our economy that are run extremely efficiently and are efficient in terms of delivering a public service to the American people that are appreciated by the American people. And we need to expand on the idea of socialism. We need to expand socialism in our economy. Okay? You know, you could look at things like Medicare. Look at things like the Veterans Administration. According to Bernie Sanders and others, it's the best health care that you can get. The satisfaction rate among Veterans Administration recipients is through the roof. The overhead with these programs is non-existent. Why? Because these programs are by and large supported by our tax dollars. Okay, and you know, most of Medicare, 80% of Medicare, involves government spending, is not privatized, government administration. So the government can operate certain areas of our economy and deliver goods and services to the American people extremely efficiently, okay? And the privatization over government resources, the privatization over large swaths of our economy has inevitably breeded waste and inefficiency. And this is one of the concepts that Peter Joseph talks about or mentions in his Zeitgeist films, how the private market is based on waste and inefficiency. Socialism is not. Socialism is based on efficiency. Socialism is based on the premise that there should be abundance in any economic system that we allow to take place. And abundance is making sure that there's enough resources to go around. And that is the enemy of our current marketplace. So in order for the capitalists to maintain scarcity, they have to keep things valuable. Things must break down. Things must depreciate. And there must be a limitation of the supply. Okay, and this is something, you know, that Marx talks about. This is something that David Harvey talks about, the limiting of supply to maintain scarcity. And this is why you people go to bed hungry in America. This is why there are 17 homes for every homeless person in America. This is why the banks sit on top of these homes. Because it's more important that somebody makes money than we as a society do the right thing. And that is an indictment on capitalism. That is an indictment on capitalism that I think that the American people are starting to wake up to. Now, another thing that Alan Moss talks about in The Case for Socialism is he has a chapter dedicated to how we change the system, okay? And one important point that he makes in this chapter is that our system is not going to change by electing a politician. And this is something, once you realize that, as Jacques Fresco says, politicians are elected to keep things the same. They're not elected to change things, okay? Democrats have to get elected, just as the Republicans do. In order for them to get elected, they have to pony up to the moneyed interests of America, which is why we've seen that the Democratic Party become more and more corporate-friendly, business-oriented, which is inevitably repressive to us, the workers, the vast majority of Americans, okay? And so once you understand that we are not going to deliver change by electing officials, by electing politicians. Politicians are elected to keep things the same, not change them. Nor do politicians have the power to change anything because of the way that the system is designed. The system is designed to preserve the status quo. So even if you get someone from the Socialist Workers Party, you get someone like, you know, myself that gets elected to a high office, it doesn't make a difference because the institutions around that leader are designed to maintain the status quo, and the amount of pressure that would be applied to the leader trying to do, you know, enact these type of changes will be overwhelming, and they'll ultimately be nullified as a result. And so, you know, the first step is to really encourage a structural analysis of our institutions. And once you start to do that, then you start to really have different answers and you start to change your line of thinking. And then it becomes that much easier to really change the system, okay? There are many different approaches to this, but I think that's the one thing that we have to understand. And so if you agree with that, if you agree with the notion that politicians are not going to change anything, they're not elected to change anything, they're elected to keep things the same. If you agree with the idea that we need a revolution, we need a complete revolution on many different areas, then why in the world would you accept this current system? Why in the world would you care about what's going to happen in 2016? Who the hell cares? Voting is toxic at this point. I think you could make an argument that that is the case, although there are many civil rights individuals out there who died supposedly for the right to vote, although Mark E. Smith would argue differently. But the point is that our current political system is basically invalid once you come to the conclusion that the political system, our economic system, and everything in between is not designed to serve the interests, is not designed to create abundance. It's designed to do the exact opposite. And so once you realize that, then, you know, you start to look at things differently, and you start to get involved with, you know, different organizations and different activist groups that are just completely outside the box. And that's the direction that I think our country is going, or at least the progressive community out there. I think that there is a real acknowledgement that the system is flawed, that capitalism in its current state, or maybe on any other state for that matter, is cancerous. And, you know, a true socialist, as Alan Mauss points out, is involved with everything, is wakes up in the morning, goes to a minimum wage rally. By noon, is focusing on LGBT issues. Then in the afternoon, in the evening, is speaking out against the privatization of our schools. And then maybe after that, you know, they're all inclusive. The fights, the struggles that shape us are everywhere, okay? And that's important. And you know, somebody said that an injustice anywhere is an injustice everywhere. Mark Thompson, the progressive host, that says that a low wage anywhere is a threat to a living wage everywhere. And that's true. That really is. We need to organize around the money that is organized around us. We have to realize, and this is something, again, that Alan Mauss points out, is that at the end of the day, there are more of us. There are more people out there that are workers. We are a nation of workers. We're not a nation of employees. We're a nation of wage earners. We're not a nation of business owners. And even though, you know, the corporate media frames it differently, in the corporate media, business is everything. There's no such thing as labor in America. There's no such thing as news that affects the wage earners. The way that labor is covered in America is only when it nuisances business, right? It's only when it bothers business. But everything is viewed through the stock market, and he who has the yardsticks, he who owns the yardsticks, controls the game, as Ralph Nader points out. And so once we realize that, and once we start to really raise class consciousness, that is when we begin to change things. It's almost a revolution in thought. It really is. We're almost out of time here on Carson's Corner, but I want to thank everybody out there for listening. I will be participating in the Left Forum that's taking place. I'm actually going to be able to meet some folks over at the commonsprojectnetwork.com who will be there May 29th through, I want to say, May 31st. A number of different speakers. Maybe some of them I'll be able to interview. I got to see what's going to happen. But I'm going to be volunteering on one day with Brad Hulhut. I'm not sure if Brad is – Brad is probably going to attend the forum for 3 days, but I'm going to be attending for at least 2 days. And as volunteer for this forum, you get to attend all 3 days and hear all the lectures and everything like that. I'm going to try to broadcast everything, you know, when I attend this forum. But others are not a big fan of this forum. In fact, one of my close friends, Eddie Goldman, I'm not afraid to not, you know, I don't think you'd mind if I mention it, you know, considers this a bunch of professors and, you know, a bunch of activism or activists and not necessarily the true work that needs to be done. But in any event, I think I value the work of some of the speakers there. David Harvey, for example, is going to be one of the speakers there. I've you know, spoken about his work, and his work is I think, very important. And so it is an important function. It really is, and that's why I'll be attending to that. I want to tell you could friend me on Facebook at facebook.com/BobCarsonMMA. Follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/BobCarsonMMA. And make sure to support the commonsprojectnetwork.com. As actually, you know, I just found out Cindy Sheehan has a show that's on there now. That's amazing. We're very proud that can take place. But, yeah, make sure to support every show. Make sure to support Brad Hulhut, Pinko the Bear Radio. Pinko the Bear, that's his almost official name. It's a great program that I highly recommend you check out. And do what you can to support Lee Camp and his ongoing moment of clarity and all his vibrant and very relevant political commentaries. A very, very important guy, very talented guy. And that is the alternative. That is the social force that is designed to question capitalism. That's what we have to maintain. We have to develop and maintain a social force designed to challenge capitalism. And that's one of the points that Alan Moss makes, another point that he makes in the case for socialism. All right, that's going to be it for this week's edition of Carson's Corner. Until next time, actually, big thanks to Frank Schaefer. Again, I want to encourage you to pick up Frank's book, Why Am I an Atheist Who Believes in God? Make sure to visit his website on frankschaefer.com. You can follow him on Twitter and friend him on Facebook. And, yes, he will respond to your emails. He's great when it comes to that stuff. And also, you know, go to Amazon and get his book. Although Amazon is not necessarily the worker-friendly business, as you know, anybody is aware of that. But find a way to pick up Frank Schaefer's book. All right, that's it for this week's edition of Carson's Corner. I'm Bob Carson. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, show some respect.